KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on the Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
From KCRW, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business. Oscar-winning actress Marlee Matlin is usually the only deaf person on a set. Speaking through her interpreter, Jack Jason, Matlin says she realized what she's been missing when she made Coda, a breakthrough film featuring deaf actors.
I mean, listen, I'm the one typically going to my trailer by myself, and it's just me and my interpreter. But in all honesty, I never thought of it until I got into the set of Coda. And I realized, oh, wait a minute, there's a whole different world out there. I've been missing all this time. Realizing that here I am on the set of Coda in my element at lunchtime, because everybody is signing. The hearing crew, they're signing. There's deaf cast members. And most importantly, our director learned sign language.
That director, Sean Hader, and Matlin tell us about making their family drama, Coda, which scored a record-breaking deal at Sundance last year and has already made history. For the first time, a film featuring a deaf cast has been nominated for Outstanding Performance at the SAG Awards. Still, Hader and Matlin tell us the industry is nowhere near where it should be in terms of accessibility. But first we banter. Stick around. It's The Business from KCRW. I am joined by my colleague and banter, Matt Bellany. Hello, Matt.
Hi there.
So our friends at NBC Universal and Comcast have recently acknowledged that Peacock isn't doing that well. It's a distant also ran in the streaming wars competition. Their numbers were so bad that they are talking about doubling their spend on programming, which will put them nowhere near their competitors, but might help. They are certainly hoping for help from the Olympics. The Olympics, however, on a number of fronts, as you know, are a big challenge.
Yeah, I mean, China. We're talking about a country that is absolutely radioactive due to the human rights abuses and some of the geopolitical issues, especially with the U.S. right now. That's one problem. Second problem is obviously COVID. There aren't going to be massive stadiums full of people. And the way that China has approached the virus is very draconian. So there will be a hotel, if you test positive, that you go to that you can't come out of. There will be very strict protocols. The NBC team is not even attending. For the most part, they're going to be broadcasting out of a building in Connecticut instead. You know, all of that kind of reduces the event nature of it. And thirdly, you know, I think the time change, you know, the fact that China is, I believe it's 13 hours ahead of New York, we're going to know all the results before we really get the primetime broadcast. So all of that is kind of dampening the expectations for these Winter Games. And it's very important for NBC. They really need to boost the subscribers at Peacock. And for the first time, you're going to be able to watch all of the Olympics via Peacock. You will not need a subscription to cable or NBC. You can do it all via Peacock, which is a big deal for them. But is anyone going to be interested? That's the question.
Yeah, we've already seen blowback about the China human rights behavior. Bob Costas said the International Olympic Committee deserves disdain and disgust for conducting games in regions with human rights abuses. COVID has cost Russia already, and this may be worse by the time this is actually being heard. It has already cost them a three-time national champion. Mikhail Kolyada had to sit out because he was positive for COVID. So it's going to be definitely difficult. I have to think that they will be heartened, maybe. I mean, not for this particular go around, as much as they really, really want this to help them, and they pay so much money for those rights at NBC Universal, but even generally across the board in the broadcast and more and more streaming world. The performance of the football playoff games recently, I mean, these were extraordinary games. There's talk that the Buffalo game against Kansas City or vice versa was perhaps the greatest game in the history of the NFL. But the ratings were absolutely huge. And we will soon know, we will know probably by the time some people are hearing this, whether the momentum continues. I have to think that that kind of magical performance on the field draws in viewers and seeing them come back. As you remember, you know, you were talking about the empty stadiums, you know, at the Olympics, empty stadiums and football didn't really help anything either. There was something about, even if you're watching it on the screen, the collective experience of fans in the stands that energizes everything, it seems.
Oh, yeah. It creates an event environment, and that's what these sports broadcasts thrive on. And, you know, NBC has the Super Bowl this year, so they're hoping that those high ratings for some of the playoff games will translate into a high Super Bowl rating. NFL is really in its own class these days, though. I don't know that we can extrapolate anything from how the NFL is doing to the Olympics. Very different. And like you said, without those crowds and without the buzz around the events, I think you lose something.
In terms of the Super Bowl, you know, the ads are always a huge deal. That is potentially going to be a problem this year. The Wall Street Journal had a story about how some advertisers are shooting alternative endings on the ads because they weren't sure where we would be in terms of like deep COVID crisis or emerging from the deep COVID crisis. And that, of course, adds to the cost.
Yeah. I mean, this is something we saw last year with the Super Bowl, where there was this kind of feeling that the ads had to toe a line of being feel good, you know, celebratory, but not insensitive to the losses and the feeling in the country. And that's, you know, something that advertisers have to think of. These brands, they base their entire year around these the Super Bowl activations. I think another problem they're seeing is that who knows in Los Angeles, where the Super Bowl is being held, whether they're going to even be able to have events around the Super Bowl. You know, usually when you are an advertiser, you will do a party or you'll put your brand on other events that are occurring. What I've heard is that most of the events in LA are still happening, albeit, you know, scaled back and outdoor. But that's a consideration. It's not going to be the, you know, the huge all-out brand-a-palooza that you usually see around the Super Bowl.
Yeah, that's what I'm hearing too. And, you know, LA, it's exciting for LA. And I think we can at least hope for nice weather, right? Like, at least we're in a place.
We'll see. I mean, the new stadium has a roof on it, so at least that is protected. But, you know, it's been a long time coming. They have a $5 billion stadium. And, you know, this is supposed to be the big coming out for LA's football scene. So we'll see.
Yeah. And a roof on a stadium in LA makes so much sense. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
That's Matt Villainy, founding partner of Puck News. The film Coda follows the Rossi family, who run a small fishing business in a coastal Massachusetts town. Coda is an acronym for Child of Deaf Adults. As the only hearing person in a close-knit family, high schooler Ruby is the one who answers radio calls on the family's fishing boat and then haggles with buyers at the market. The film explores the tension that arises between Ruby and her parents, played by Troy Kotsur and Marley Matlin, as Ruby edges towards seeking more independence. Ruby is drifting through high school until she sees her crush sign up for choir and makes a last-minute decision to do the same. She soon encounters the school's choir teacher, played by Eugenio Derbez.
You're the girl with the deaf family? Everyone but you?
Yeah.
And you sing? Interesting. Are you any good?
I don't know.
Ruby will soon find out. Coda was written and directed by Sean Hader, a filmmaker who was a writer and producer on Orange is the New Black and Little America. Hader is joined today by Marley Matlin, who won Best Actress at the 1987 Academy Awards for her performance in Children of a Lesser God. 35 years later, Matlin remains the only deaf actor even to be nominated for an Oscar. Coda is a remake of a European film, but both Hader and Matlin, who signed to us over Zoom while Jack Jason interpreted, knew from the beginning that their version would be quite different. So it was a French film with hearing actors in the deaf roles. I don't know, Sean. I mean, I know Marley was having no part of that. We'll get to that in 1 second. But were you having no part of that?
I was having no part of it either. I mean, looked to try to kind of go through film history and figure out what movies had ever portrayed deaf characters or deaf family on screen. I was going back 35 years to Children of a Lesser God, and, you know, which was Marley when she was 19. And there weren't examples out there of deaf characters, and particularly not three at the center of a film. And that was my interest in making the film at all. And so I dove into deaf culture as I was writing. I did a ton of research. I felt so invested in the community and in doing this right. And then it was a bit shocking to me when I met with resistance when I wanted to cast deaf actors. And it also felt, you know, at the time it was a studio movie and there was a certain financing model that they were used to. And, you know, they presented it as like, this is this puzzle that's unsolvable, you know, and we don't know how to do this. And I met with Marley the first time and expressed to her that I was in this kind of fight and felt alone and felt like I was standing up by myself about the way that I wanted to make this film. And Marley was like, well, I'm only making this film if it's three deaf actors in the lead and I'll walk away and we don't have to make it that way. And so, and I felt that way too. I felt like I would walk away. So I think we both got to go back to the studio and say, this is the only way to make the movie. And if you guys don't want to make it this way, then maybe it dies here. Maybe we find another way to make it. But there, I wasn't interested in the other version of this film.
You know, we were enthusiastic. I mean, I was really so in love with the script and with the story and with the idea. And the fact that there were three deaf characters carrying a film for the first time ever. So I really believed that it should have been done the way that Sean wanted to do it. And we went back and forth and we were so excited to talk about different ways to tackle the script and different points in the story. And then I heard Sean saying with hesitation about the part being played by a hearing person. I thought, well, wait a minute. Why? Why are we going backwards? Today, they should know that there are deaf actors out there that could make the movie work. And it felt a little bit discriminatory, I can say. But listen, you have to understand. Studios don't necessarily have to understand because they have their own models. All they have to understand is that we should collaborate, that we should work together, have a conversation. And so hopefully, and I trust that CODA, now that it's out, studios will look at this, see a successful model and receive us more openly than ever.
And to be clear, I don't think this was a like, we don't want to cast deaf actors in the movie. I think this was an unusual movie to be getting made at a studio anyway. You know, I think it wasn't a genre movie. It wasn't based on any IP.
Yeah. So in today's world, that's a very hard movie to get made. Yeah. Because Lionsgate, correct me if I'm wrong, I think Lionsgate couldn't figure out. It wasn't their thing. Let's put it that way.
I think it wasn't their thing. I think it was an unusual movie to be happening there anyway. You know, Patrick Washberger, it was his baby and he loved it. But I think it wasn't maybe the best fit for the studio. You know, so Marley, yes, was the first person attached. I think right after I finished the script, I went out to her. I had had her in mind when I was writing and she was the first person to come on board the project. And I think, you know, as Marley was saying, there were a wealth of deaf actors out there, largely in the theater world. I mean, the National Theater for the Deaf and then Deaf West has been an incredible kind of place where deaf actors have been able to work. And there's a ton of talent. And so I think once we saw that, then it sort of seemed like I could present, hey, guys, go watch Troy Kotsur and then argue with me that that is not the right person for this role. So I think it became a lot easier once we were auditioning and able to sort of put it out there. And yet, you know, the film eventually was made independently for a lot less money outside of the studio system. And we had to complicated process to get it out, but we did it. And it was made the right way at the end of the day, I think.
Yeah, I was going to go to Troy Kotsur. I mean, your ensemble is great, as has clearly been recognized by the Screen Actors Guild. But he is such an amazing performance from a person that hasn't been seen before, I think, in the hearing world. And I have to think, Marley, from your standpoint, there's just maybe a little bit of bittersweetness that he gets this moment. He's not a kid and he's so talented and finally gets a showcase. But finally, right? It took so long.
Yeah, I mean, he's been around, as you said, for a long time, 30 plus years in the theater world. He's an accomplished stage actor. He's been there for the longest time. And every show that he's been in, I've always made it a point of watching him, being there in attendance, going to see him. And his wife, Deanne Bray, she is an actress as well. And she's just as brilliant. And we've been friends for a long time. And I kept telling her, he needs to be seen. He needs to be seen in the movie world. He needs to be seen in the industry. And she said, well, what can we do? I mean, I don't know where to start. And I knew he really had so much talent with him beyond what he did on stage that when I first read the script for Coda, Troy's name screamed at me off the page. I told Sean immediately, you have to hire Troy. And she said, I'm already on it. And I'm glad that Sean recognized his work. And I can't even imagine anybody else playing Frank Rossi in Coda. I really can't. And I trust that because of this film, it's the beginning of a very, very promising career, bigger than ever, hopefully.
So ASL is a very rich language, and the translation of lines from the written word on a page to ASL, there's just a wealth of choices that can be made. So I just wonder how you approach that script with the options available and how much of it is, you know, it's not just hands, right? It's more than just hands. It's body, it's face, it's everything.
First of all, I grew up, it's interesting, we did what was called total communication, which was signing and speaking. And that's called signing exact English, signing what's written in English on the page. That is not American Sign Language. So to do Jackie's role, I have never played a character that was speaking pure ASL without hearing aids. I always wear my hearing aids when I'm working and whatever character that I'm playing over all these years. This time it was different. I took off my hearing aids, and that was a big challenge for me. And as an actor, learning the lines in ASL. So it was, I mean, it was an opportunity to sign American Sign Language, pure ASL. Jackie was completely immersed in the world of deaf culture. And again, it depends on the context of the conversation, what's going on around you, where you can choose the particular ASL vocabulary for whatever word that you're trying to express or thought you're trying to express. And yeah, it also includes, as you said, it includes your face, your body, the entire, I mean, it's just about what the culture is. It's American Sign Language is just not hand movements. It's all of that. So the opportunity to do this role as an actor was a privilege.
Coming up after a short break, Marley Matlin says one small but meaningful thing that Hollywood could do for the deaf community is to spell out swear words in captions. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes. Join Jacqueline Coley as she hosts a brand new podcast, Scene on the Screen. Meet the innovative people at NBC Universal as they share their journeys, inspirations, and the movies that define them. Each episode is an intimate and fun conversation about the impact of film. Scene on the Screen is available now wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. We're talking to filmmaker Sean Hader and actress Marley Matlin about their movie Coda, now streaming on Apple TV+. The film tells the story of Ruby, a coda, or child of deaf adults. A high school senior who loves to sing, Ruby is also a crucial part of her family's fishing business. Her parents and brother rely on her to interpret in a variety of settings. Ruby reaches a crossroads when she discovers that her talent for singing might open a path to new opportunities that would lead her away from her small town and away from her family. Marley Matlin plays Ruby's mother, Jackie, while Troy Kotsur, a veteran stage actor, plays Ruby's father. He has a SAG nomination for Best Supporting Actor, and the whole cast is nominated for Best Ensemble. Matlin is used to being the only deaf person on a set. With Coda, of course, her experience was wonderfully different.
On this set, everyone signs, from my left side to my right side. And when it came to lunch, I wasn't the only one. I mean, listen, I'm the one typically going to my trailer by myself, and it's just me and my interpreter. But in all honesty, I never thought of it until I got into the set of Coda and I realized, oh, wait a minute, there's a whole different world out there. I've been missing all this time. Realizing that here I am on the set of Coda in my element at lunchtime because everybody is signing. The hearing crew, they're signing. There's deaf cast members. And our, most importantly, our director learned sign language. And sometimes she would say, you know what? I don't need the interpreter. Or I would push aside the interpreter and Sean and I would work together one-on-one, and it worked for us. So Sean really immersed herself into our community, into our culture, which is extremely helpful. Because a lot of times when I work with different directors, and I'm not, no offense to these directors, but my experience has always been, okay, can I get something from you as an actor? One take, two take. And they'll say, oh, no, that's fine, Marley. You know, you did fine. But they really don't have a chance to analyze my work because they don't have the knowledge. And I'm not talking about all of them. I'm just saying that's what it was. And yeah, the set, it was family friendly, deaf friendly. And I'm curious to see what it's going to be like for the next film that I work on. Who knows?
Well, I read that there were things like the arrangement of the furniture, that a deaf family would not have a couch facing away from the door because they need to see who's coming in and out.
There were these two women on the film who were my ASL masters or my directors of ASL, Alexandria Wales and Anne Tomasetti. And Alexandria did the original translation of the script with me into ASL. And then Anne was on set with us every step of the way. And it was so important for exactly what you're talking about. I mean, Anne walked onto the set and, you know, along with Marley was like, no deaf family is setting up their living room furniture like this. Like, and as Marley was saying, I think a lot of the reason that directors don't give notes to deaf actors is this feeling of like, oh, well, you're doing your ASL thing and I don't really know what that is. So if you're doing it, it must be correct. Well, I don't necessarily know if my actors flub their lines. I don't know if Troy is throwing in secret swear words that I can't notice, which he was doing right and left.
So, and the script supervisor wouldn't know either. The script supervisor wouldn't know either. So, I mean, that being said, I think Sean brings out a very important point, which is that whenever you're working with deaf actors, you have to collaborate. And studios need to understand the importance of maybe putting in an extra crew member when it comes to a deaf actor, like a director of ASL, because the tools that we do that we need in a set are important, and this is just one part of it. It's just critical. So we're lucky that Sean really took the reins and took the time to understand and collaborate with us and let us communicate together.
The film goes to Sundance, gets this amazing deal, wins prizes, all kinds of accolades. There has been some critique from the deaf community that the family is so dependent on the daughter. And I wonder, Marley, maybe you're the person to address that. Is that a valid
critique?
What
do they know? I mean, every family is different. If they've not experienced it, how can they say that that family isn't authentic? Bottom line is that each deaf household is different. We come in all sorts of sizes and colors. I have four kids, and my family might be different than another family. Sometimes I rely on my kids to interpret. A lot of times they have this instinct to help me and interpret. If they know that I didn't hear something, or if there was something that was important for me to see or hear.
I think one of the things that's challenging, which I do understand, when you are representing a community that never gets represented and has been misrepresented for so long, there is an expectation on one story to make up for that lack of...
Right. It carries the load of all the untold stories.
The load of all the untold stories and to message exactly what needs to be messaged, right? So I think what needs to be messaged in the world, which I agree with, is that there should be access everywhere. There should be an interpreter at the doctor's office. There should be an interpreter if you go to City Hall and you're having a meeting with your local, you know, all of these places. It's illegal to not have interpreters in those situations. The fact is that if you're not in a big city, if you're poor, interpreters are expensive and cost money. There is a reliance sometimes on family members in those situations. So I completely hear that critique because I do understand that it's like, well, I don't want people to think that this is okay, that this 17-year-old girl is relied on to do these things. And the fact is it's not okay. There should be a professional interpreter in all these situations.
The reality is that I can tell you for some deaf people choose not to use interpreters. They'd rather not have an interpreter in sensitive situations. So, yeah.
Now, Marley, you've done years and years of advocacy. In terms of work, you know, I'm looking at a quote. You said that because deaf actors don't get as many opportunities to work, they lose their insurance. The unions need to step up. That's me quoting you to you. I don't know. We've seen a lot of talk and about representation and inclusion. How are we feeling about where we are.
It's completely crazy. For example, during the pandemic, with COVID, most people weren't working, as you pointed out. And so fine, we're all in this together. But while everyone started to go back to work, we weren't able to as deaf and disabled actors. And we had to really work to get work in order to qualify for our benefits. And, you know, it's a matter of accessibility. I mean, you know, people think about having to do all this work. Well, to hire a deaf actor is going to be a lot of work, but not really. And I think it's a struggle. It still is. And we just have to continue to make noise.
There's also, I mean, I think there's something interesting about Hollywood messaging inclusion and all of these things until they're asked to change or adjust. You know, we're so lucky to be in the awards conversation at all. And it's been amazing, but it's also sort of highlighted for me all of these little moments where you go, you know, we'll do a day of panels and it's a bunch of movies, right? It's all the movies that are sort of in the conversation, and an interpreter gets trotted out for CODA and does the 10-minute panel with us. And then that interpreter gets trotted off the stage with us. And I'm like, well, do you not think that deaf people don't care about Belfast, or they don't want to hear about King Richard? It's like the idea that you would only caption content that is, you know, about deaf characters and not just caption everything or put an interpreter there for the entire day so that the entire program is accessible. So I think these things are tricky because then you feel like, well, I'm grateful to be here. I'm so lucky that we've ended up here. At the same time, I often feel like I need to stand up and go like, hey guys, like what if it wasn't just CODA clip that was captioned in these ceremonies? What if all of the clips were captioned so that my actors and the deaf people watching at home could participate in this? So it's tricky. It's hard to be invited to the party and feel like you don't want to ruffle feathers or raise your voice too loud, but it's something that I'm witnessing and I feel really sensitive to. And it feels like something people need to look at.
I mean, this thing about captioning that Sean brings up, and, you know, recently, you know, there was an announcement for the nominations for the SAG Awards. The live announcement wasn't captioned. I mean, it's captioning is everywhere, and it's not just for deaf people. So, I mean, you know, you're looking at a bar, you're looking at the airport, at the television set, whatever it may be. So to take away or to say, oh, the technology is not there. Listen, things like that just don't make sense to me. And you know what? It may sound weird, but my latest beef has been watching television or being at, especially on an airplane where there's captions and they don't fully caption swear words. They'll say FXXX, but they don't blur the hands. I can see what they're saying. So, you know, I'm still reading and understanding the word. Why do they deprive us of seeing swear words, for example? There's so many things that I have to focus on. And it's just all about collaborating with each other and educating each other and taking people with us. Just ask us questions. We can give you good answers. But we still have a lot of work to do.
Marlee Matlin is one of the stars of CODA, and Jack Jason is interpreting. Sean Hader is the writer and director. Thank you all very much for joining us. Great conversation.
Thank you. It was wonderful to be here.
Thanks. Thanks so much.
And that's The Business. Caitlin Parker produced and edited today's program with help this week from Paul Smith, who also mixed the show. You can stream The Business as well as other great KCRW podcasts on the KCRW app. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.
KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on the Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.